speak. Although if he were to tell anyone, he knew it would be Willem. He admired all three of his roommates, but Willem was the one he trusted. At the home, he had quickly learned that there were three types of boys. The first type might cause the fight. This was J.B. The second type wouldn't join in, but wouldn't run to get help either. This was Malcolm. And the third type would actually try to help you out. This was the rarest type, and this was obviously Willem. Maybe it was the same with girls as well, but he hadn't spent enough time around girls to know this for sure. And increasingly, he was certain Willem knew something. Knows what, he'd argue with himself, in saner moments. You're just looking for a reason to tell him, and then what will he think of you? Be smart. Say nothing. Have some self-control. But this was, of course, illogical. He knew even before he got to college that his childhood had been atypical. You had only to read a few books to come to that conclusion. But it wasn't until recently that he had realized how atypical it truly was. Its very strangeness both insulated and isolated him. It was near inconceivable that anyone would guess at its shape and specificities, which meant that if they did, it was because he had dropped clues like cow turds, great, ugly, unmissable pleas for attention. Still, the suspicion persisted, sometimes with an uncomfortable intensity, as if it was inevitable that he should say something and was being sent messages that took more energy to ignore than they would have to obey. One night it was just the four of them. This was early in their third year, and it was unusual enough for them all to feel cozy and a little sentimental about the clique they had made. And they were a clique, and to his surprise, he was part of it. The building they lived in was called Hood Hall, and they were known around campus as the Boys in the Hood. All of them had other friends, J.B. and Willem had the most, but it was known, or at least assumed, which was just as good, that their first loyalties were to one another. None of them had ever discussed this explicitly, but they all knew they liked this assumption, that they liked this code of friendship that had been imposed upon them. The food that night had been pizza, ordered by J.B. and paid for by Malcolm. There had been weed, procured by J.B., and outside there had been rain and then hail, the sound of it cracking against the glass and the wind rattling the windows in their splintered wooden casements, the final elements in their happiness. The joint went round and round, and although he didn't take a puff, he never did. He was too worried about what he might do or say if he lost control over himself. He could feel the smoke filling his eyes, pressing upon his eyelids like a shaggy, warm beast. He had been careful, as he always was when one of the others paid for food, to eat as little as possible. And although he was still hungry, there were two slices left over, and he stared at them fixedly before catching himself and turning away resolutely. He was also deeply content. I could fall asleep, he thought, and stretched out on the couch, pulling Malcolm's blanket over him as he did. He was pleasantly exhausted, but then he was always exhausted those days. It was as if the daily effort it took to appear normal was so great that it left energy for little else. He was aware sometimes of seeming wooden, icy, of being boring, which he recognized that here might have been considered the greater misfortune than being whatever it was he was. In the background, as if far away, he could hear Malcolm and J.B. having a fight about evil.
I'm just saying, we wouldn't be having this argument if you'd read Plato.
Yeah, but what Plato?
Have you read Plato?
I don't see...
Have you?
No, but...
See? See? See?
That would be Malcolm, jumping up and down and pointing at J.B. while Willem laughed. On weed, Malcolm grew both sillier and more pedantic, and the three of them liked getting into silly and pedantic philosophical arguments with him, the contents of which Malcolm could never recall in the morning. Then there was an interlude of Willem and J.B. talking about something. He was too sleepy to really listen, just awake enough to distinguish their voices, and then J.B.'s voice, ringing through his fog.
Jude!
What?
He answered, his eyes still closed. I want to ask you a question. He could instantly feel something inside him come alert. When high, J.B. had the uncanny ability to ask questions or make observations that both devastated and discomfited. He didn't think there was any malice behind it, but it made you wonder what went on in J.B.'s subconscious. Was this the real J.B., the one who had asked their hallmate, Trisha Park, what it was like growing up as the ugly twin? Poor Trisha had gotten up and run out of the room. Or was it the one who, after J.B. had witnessed him in the grip of a terrible episode, one in which he could feel himself falling in and out of consciousness, the sensation as sickening as tumbling off a roller coaster in mid-incline, had snuck out that night with his stoner boyfriend and returned just before daybreak with a bundle of bud-furred magnolia branches sawn off illegally from the quadrangle's trees?
What?
He asked again, warily.
Well, said J.B., pausing and taking another inhalation. We've all known each other a while now.
We have?
Willem asked in fake surprise.
Shut up, Willem, J.B. continued. And all of us want to know why you've never told us what happened to your legs.
Oh, J.B., we do not—
Willem began, but Malcolm, who had the habit of vociferously taking J.B.'s side when stoned, interrupted him.
It really hurts our feelings, Jude. Do you not trust us?
Jesus, Malcolm,
Willem said, and then, mimicking Malcolm in a shrieky falsetto,
it really hurts our feelings. You sound like a girl. It's Jude's business.
And this was worse somehow, having to have Willem, always Willem, defend him, against Malcolm and J.B. At that moment, he hated all of them. But of course he was in no position to hate them. They were his friends, his first friends, and he understood that friendship was a series of exchanges, of affections, of time, sometimes of money, always of information. And he had no money. He had nothing to give them. He had nothing to offer. He couldn't loan Willem a sweater, the way Willem let him borrow his, or repay Malcolm the $100 he'd pressed upon him once, or even help J.B. on move-out day as J.B. helped him.
Well, he began, and was aware of all their perked silences, even Willem's. It's not very interesting.
He kept his eyes closed, both because it made it easier to tell the story when he didn't have to look at them, and also because he simply didn't think he could stand it at the moment.
It was a car injury. I was 15. It was the year before I came here.
Oh, said J.B. There was a pause. He could feel something in the room deflate, could feel how his revelation had shifted the others back into a sort of somber sobriety.
I'm sorry, bro. That sucks. You could walk before?
Asked Malcolm, as if he could not walk now. And this made him sad and embarrassed. What he considered walking, they apparently did not.
Yes, he said, and then, because it was true, even if not the way they'd interpret it, he added, I used to run cross-country.
Oh, wow, said Malcolm.
J.B. made a sympathetic grunting noise. Only Willem, he noticed, said nothing. But he didn't dare open his eyes to look at his expression. Eventually the word got out, as he knew it would. Perhaps people really did wonder about his legs. Trisha Park later came up to him and told him she'd always assumed he had cerebral palsy. What was he supposed to say to that? Somehow, though, over the tellings and retellings, the explanation was changed to a car accident, and then to a drunken driving accident. The easiest explanations are often the right ones. His math professor, Dr. Lee, always said, and maybe the same principle applied here. Except he knew it didn't. Math was one thing. Nothing else was that reductive. But the odd thing was this. By his story morphing into one about a car accident, he was being given an opportunity for reinvention. All he had to do was claim it. But he never could. He could never call it an accident, because it wasn't. And so was it pride or stupidity to not take the escape route he'd been offered? He didn't know. And then he noticed something else. He was in the middle of another episode, a highly humiliating one. It had taken place just as he was coming off his shift at the library, and Willem had just happened to be there a few minutes early, about to start his own shift, when he heard the librarian, a kind, well-read woman whom he liked, ask why he had these. They had moved him, Mrs. Eakley and Willem, to the break room in the back, and he could smell the burned sugar tang of old coffee, a scent he despised anyway, so sharp and assaultive that he almost vomited. A car injury, he heard Willem's reply, as if from across a great black lake. But it wasn't until that night that he registered what Willem had said and the word he had used. Injury, not accident. Was it deliberate, he wondered. What did Willem know? He was so addled that he might have actually asked him, had Willem been around, but he wasn't. He was at his girlfriend's. No one was there, he realized. The room was his. He felt the creature inside him, which he pictured as slight and raggedy and lemur-like, quick-reflexed and ready to sprint, its dark, wet eyes forever scanning the landscape for future dangers, relax and sag to the ground. It was at these moments that he found college most enjoyable. He was in a warm room, and the next day he would have 3 meals and eat as much as he wanted, and in between he would go to classes, and no one would try to hurt him or make him do anything he didn't want to do. Somewhere nearby were his roommates, his friends, and he had survived another day without divulging any of his secrets, and placed another day between the person he once was and the person he was now. It seemed always an accomplishment worthy of sleep, and so he did, closing his eyes and readying himself for another day in the world. It had been Anna, his first and only social worker, and the first person who had never betrayed him, who had talked to him seriously about college, the college he ended up attending, and who was convinced that he would get in. She hadn't been the first person to suggest this, but she had been the most insistent. "I don't see why not," she said. It was a favorite phrase of hers. The two of them were sitting on Anna's porch in Anna's backyard, eating banana bread that Anna's girlfriend had made. Anna didn't care for nature. Too buggy, too squirmy, she always said. But when he made the suggestion that they go outdoors, tentatively, because at the time he was still unsure where the boundaries of her tolerance for him lay, she'd slapped the edges of her armchair and heaved herself up. "I don't see why not. Leslie?" she called into the kitchen, where Leslie was making lemonade. "You can bring it outside." Hers was the first face he saw when he had at last opened his eyes in the hospital. For a long moment, he couldn't remember where he was, or who he was, or what had happened. And then, suddenly, her face was above his, looking at him. "Well, well," she said. "He awakes." She was always there, it seemed, no matter what time he woke. Sometimes it was day, and he heard the sounds of the hospital, a mouse squeak of the nurse's shoes, and the clatter of a cart, and the drone of the intercom announcements, in the hazy, half-formed moments he had before shifting into full consciousness. But sometimes it was night, when everything was silent around him, and it took him longer to figure out where he was and why he was there, although it came back to him, it always did. And unlike some realizations, it never grew easier or fuzzier with each remembrance. And sometimes it was neither day nor night, but somewhere in between. And there would be something strange and dusty about the light that made him imagine for a moment that there might after all be such a thing as heaven, and that he might after all have made it there. And then he would hear Anna's voice and remember again why he was there, and want to close his eyes all over again. They talked of nothing in those moments. She would ask him if he was hungry, and no matter his answer, she would have a sandwich for him to eat. She would ask him if he was in pain, and if he was, how intense it was. It was in her presence that he'd had the first of his episodes, and the pain had been so awful, unbearable almost, as if someone had reached in and grabbed his spine like a snake and was trying to loose it from its bundles of nerves by shaking it, that later, when the surgeon told him that an injury like his was an insult to the body and one the body would never recover from completely, he had understood what the word meant and realized how correct and well chosen it was.
"You mean he's going to have these all his life?"
Anna had asked, and he had been grateful for her outrage, especially because he was too tired and frightened to summon forth any of his own. "I wish I could say no," said the surgeon. And then, to him, "But they may not be this severe in the future. You're young now. The spine has wonderful reparative qualities." "Jude," she'd said to him when the next one came, 2 days after the first. He could hear her voice, but as if from far away, and then suddenly awfully close, filling his mind like explosions.
"Hold on to my hand," she'd said,
and again her voice swelled and receded, but she seized his hand, and he held it so tightly he could feel her index finger slide oddly over her ring finger, could almost feel every small bone in her palm reposition themselves in his grip, which had the effect of making her seem like something delicate and intricate, although there was nothing delicate about her in either appearance or manner. "Count," she commanded him, the third time it happened, and he did, counting up to 100 again and again, parsing the pain into negotiable increments. In those days, before he learned it was better to be still, he would flop on his bed like a fish on a boat deck, his free hand scrabbling for a halyard line to cling to for safety, the hospital mattress unyielding and uncaring, searching for a position in which the discomfort might lessen. He tried to be quiet, but he could hear himself making strange animal noises, so that at times a forest appeared beneath his eyelids, populated with screech owls and deer and bears, and he would imagine he was one of them, and that the sounds he was making were normal, part of the wood's unceasing soundtrack. When it had ended, she would give him some water, a straw in the glass so he wouldn't have to raise his head. Beneath him, the floor tilted and bucked, and he was often sick. He had never been in the ocean, but he imagined this was what it might feel like. Imagine the swells of water forcing the linoleum floor into quavering hillocks. "Good boy," she'd say as he drank. "Have a little more. It'll get better," she'd say. And he'd nod, because he couldn't begin to imagine his life if it didn't get better. His days now were hours. Hours without pain and hours with it. And the unpredictability of this schedule and his body, although it was his in name only, for he could control nothing of it, exhausted him, and he slept and slept, the days slipping away from him uninhabited. Later it would be easier to simply tell people that it was his legs that hurt him, but that wasn't really true. It was his back. Sometimes he could predict what would trigger the spasming. That pain that would extend down his spine into one leg or the other, like a wooden stake set aflame and thrust into him. A certain movement, lifting something too heavy or too high, simple tiredness. But sometimes he couldn't, and sometimes the pain would be preceded by an interlude of numbness, or a twinging that was almost pleasurable, it was so light and zingy. Just a sensation of electric prickles moving up and down his spine, and he would know to lie down and wait for it to finish its cycle, a penance he could never escape or avoid. But sometimes it barged in, and those were the worst. He grew fearful that it would arrive at some terribly inopportune time, and before each big meeting, each big interview, each court appearance, he would beg his own back to still itself, to carry him through the next few hours without incident. But all of this was in the future, and each lesson he learned, he did so over hours and hours of these episodes, stretched out over days and months and years. As the weeks passed, she brought him books and told him to write down titles he was interested in, and she would go to the library and get them, but he was too shy to do so. He knew she was his social worker, and that she had been assigned to him, but it wasn't until more than a month had passed, and the doctors had begun to talk about his casts being removed in a matter of weeks, that she first asked him about what had happened. "I don't remember," he said. It was his default answer for everything back then. It was a lie as well. In uninvited moments, he'd see the car's headlights, twinned glares of white, rushing toward him, and recall how he'd shut his eyes and jerked his head to the side, as if that might have prevented the inevitable. She waited. "It's okay, Jude," she said. "We basically know what happened. But I need you to tell me at some point so we can talk about it." She had interviewed him earlier. Did he remember? There had apparently been a moment soon after he'd come out of the first surgery that he had woken, lucid, and answered all her questions, not only about what had happened that night, but in the years before it as well. But he honestly didn't remember this at all, and he fretted about what exactly he had said and what Anna's expression had been when he'd told her. "How much had he told her?" he asked at one point. "Enough," she said, "to convince me that there's a hell and that those men need to be in it." She didn't sound angry, but her words were, and he closed his eyes, impressed and a little scared that the things that had happened to him, could inspire such passion, such vitriol. She oversaw his transfer into his new home, his final home, the Douglases. They had two other fosters, both girls, both young. Rosie was 8 and had Down syndrome. Agnes was 9 and had spina bifida. The house was a maze of ramps, unlovely but sturdy and smooth, and unlike Agnes, he could wheel himself around without asking for assistance. The Douglases were evangelical Lutherans, but they didn't make him attend church with them. "They're good people," Anna said. "They won't bother you, and you'll be safe here. You think you can manage Grace at the table for a little privacy and guaranteed security?" She looked at him and smiled. He nodded. "Besides," she continued, "you can always call me if you want to talk sin." And indeed, he was in Anna's care more than in the Douglases. He slept in their house and ate there, and when he was first learning how to move on his crutches, it was Mr. Douglas who sat on a chair outside the bathroom, ready to enter if he slipped and fell getting into or out of the bathtub. He still wasn't able to balance well enough to take a shower, even with a walker. But it was Anna who took him to most of his doctor's appointments, and Anna who waited at one end of her backyard, a cigarette in her mouth, as he took his first slow steps toward her, and Anna who finally got him to write down what had happened with Dr. Traylor and kept him from having to testify in court. He had said he could do it, but she had told him he wasn't ready yet, and that they had plenty of evidence to put Dr. Traylor away for years, even without his testimony, and hearing that, he was able to admit his own relief. Relief at not having to say aloud words he didn't know how to say, and mostly relief that he wouldn't have to see Dr. Traylor again. When he at last gave her the statement, which he'd written as plainly as possible, and had imagined while writing it that he was in fact writing about someone else, someone he had known once but had never had to talk to again, she read through it once, impassive, before nodding at him. "Good," she said briskly, and refolded it and placed it back in its envelope. "Good job," she added, and then, suddenly, she began to cry, almost ferociously, unable to stop herself. She was saying something to him, but she was weeping so hard he couldn't understand her, and she had finally left, though she had called him later that night to apologize.
"I'm sorry, Jude," she said. "That was really unprofessional of me. I just read what you wrote, and I just..."
She was silent for a period, and then took breath.
"It won't happen again."
It was also Anna who, after the doctors determined he wouldn't be strong enough to go to school, found him a tutor so he could finish high school, and it was she who made him discuss college.
"You're really smart, did you know that?" she asked him. "You could go anywhere, really. I talked to some of your teachers in Montana, and they think so as well. Have you thought about it? You have? Where would you want to go?"
And when he told her, preparing himself for her to laugh, she instead only nodded.
"I don't see why not. But," he began, "do you think they'd take someone like me?"
Once again, she didn't laugh.
"It's true you haven't had the most traditional of educations," she smiled at him. "But your tests are terrific, and although you probably don't think so, I promise you know more than most, if not all, kids your age."
She sighed.
"You may have something to thank Brother Luke for, after all."
She studied his face.
"So I don't see why not."
She helped him with everything. She wrote one of his recommendations. She let him use her computer to type up his essay. He didn't write about the past year. He wrote about Montana and how he'd learned there to forage for mustard shoots and mushrooms. She even paid for his application fee. When he was accepted, with a full scholarship, as Anna had predicted, he told her it was all because of her.
"Bullshit," she said.
She was so sick by that point that she could only whisper it.
"You did it yourself."
Later, he would scan through the previous months and see, as if spotlit, the signs of her illness, and how, in his stupidity and self-absorption, he had missed one after the next. Her weight loss, her yellowing eyes, her fatigue, all of which he had attributed to... what?
"You shouldn't smoke,"
he'd said to her just 2 months earlier, confident enough around her now to start issuing orders. The first adult he'd done so to.
"You're right," she'd said, and squinted her eyes at him while inhaling deeply, grinning at him when he sighed at her.
Even then, she didn't give up.
"Jude, we should talk about it," she'd say every few days,
and when he shook his head, she'd be silent.
"Tomorrow, then,"
she'd say.
"Do you promise me? Tomorrow we'll talk about it." "I don't see why I have to talk about it at all,"
he muttered at her once. He knew she had read his records from Montana. He knew she knew what he was. She was quiet.
"One thing I've learned," she said. "You have to talk about these things while they're fresh, or you'll never talk about them. I'm going to teach you how to talk about them, because it's going to get harder and harder the longer you wait, and it's going to fester inside you, and you're always going to think you're to blame. You'll be wrong, of course, but you'll always think it."
He didn't know how to respond to that, but the next day, when she brought it up again, he shook his head and turned away from her, even though she called after him.
"Jude," she said once, "I've let you go on for too long without addressing this. This is my fault." "Do it for me, Jude," she said at another point.
But he couldn't. He couldn't find the language to talk about it, not even to her. Besides, he didn't want to relive those years. He wanted to forget them, to pretend they belonged to someone else. By June, she was so weak she couldn't sit. 14 months after they'd met, she was the one in bed, and he was the one next to her. Leslie worked the day shift at the hospital, and so often it was just the two of them in the house.
"Listen,"
she said. Her throat was dry from one of her medications, and she winced as she spoke. He reached for the jug of water, but she waved her hand impatiently.
"Leslie's going to take you shopping before you leave. I made a list for her of things you'll need.
He started to protest, but she stopped him. Don't argue, Jude. I don't have the energy. She swallowed. He waited. You're going to be great at college, she said. She shut her eyes. The other kids are going to ask you about how you grew up. Have you thought about that? Sort of, he said. It was all he thought about. She grunted. She didn't believe him either. What are you going to tell them? And then she opened her eyes and looked at him. I don't know, he admitted. Yes, she said. They were quiet. Jude, she began, and then stopped. You'll find your own way to discuss what happened to you. You'll have to, if you ever want to be close to anyone. But your life, no matter what you think, you have nothing to be ashamed of, and none of it has been your fault. Will you remember that? It was the closest they had ever gotten to discussing not only the previous year, but the years that preceded it, too. Yes, he told her. She glared at him. Promise me. I promise. But even then, he couldn't believe her. She sighed. I should have made you talk more, she said. It was the last thing she ever said to him. 2 weeks later, July 3rd, she was dead. Her service was the week after that. By this point, he had a summer job at a local bakery, where he sat in the back room spackling cakes with fondant, and in the days following the funeral, he sat until night at his workstation, plastering cake after cake with carnation pink icing, trying not to think of her. At the end of July, the Douglases moved. Mr. Douglas had gotten a new job in San Jose, and they were taking Agnes with them. Rosie was being reassigned to a different family. He had liked the Douglases, but when they had told him to stay in touch, he knew he wouldn't. He was so desperate to move away from the life he was in, the life he'd had. He wanted to be someone whom no one knew, and who knew no one. He was put into emergency shelter. That was what the state called it, emergency shelter. He'd argued that he was old enough to be left on his own. He imagined also, illogically, that he would sleep in the back room of the bakery, and that in less than 2 months, he'd be gone anyway, out of the system entirely, but no one agreed with him. The shelter was a dormitory, a sagging gray honeycomb populated by other kids who, because of what they had done, or what had been done to them, or simply how old they were, the state couldn't easily place. When it was time for him to leave, they gave him some money to buy supplies for school. They were, he recognized, vaguely proud of him. He might not have been in the system for long, but he was going to college, and to a superior college at that. He would forever after be claimed as one of their successes. Leslie drove him to the Army-Navy store. He wondered, as he chose things he thought he might need, 2 sweaters, 3 long-sleeve shirts, pants, a gray blanket that resembled the clotty stuffing that vomited forth from the sofa in the shelter's lobby, if he was getting the correct things, the things that might have been on Anna's list. He couldn't stop himself from thinking that there was something else on that list, something essential that Anna thought he needed that he would now never know. At nights, he craved that list, sometimes more than he craved her. He could picture it in his mind, the funny up-and-down capitalizations she inserted into a single word, the mechanical pencil she always used, the yellow legal pads left over from her years as a lawyer on which she made her notes. Sometimes the letters solidified into words, and in the dream life, he'd feel triumphant. Ah, he'd think, of course that's what I need. Of course Anna would know. But in the mornings, he could never remember what those things were. In those moments, he wished, perversely, that he had never met her. That it was surely worse to have had her for so brief a period than to never have had her at all. They gave him a bus ticket north, Leslie came to the station to see him off. He had packed his things in a double-layered black garbage bag and then inside the backpack he'd bought at the Army-Navy store. Everything he owned in one neat package. On the bus, he stared out the window and thought of nothing. He hoped his back wouldn't betray him on the ride, and it didn't. He had been the first to arrive in their room, and when the second boy came in, it had been Malcolm, with his parents and suitcases and books and speakers and television and phones and computers and refrigerator and flotillas of digital gadgetry. He had felt the first sensations of sickening fear and then anger directed irrationally at Anna. How could she let him believe he might be equipped to do this? Who could he say he was? Why had she never told him exactly how poor, how ugly, what a scrap of bloodied, muddied cloth his life really was? Why had she let him believe he might belong here? As the months passed, this feeling dampened, but it never disappeared. It lived on him like a thin scum of mold. But as that knowledge became more acceptable, another piece became less so. He began to realize that she was the first and last person to whom he would never have to explain anything. She knew that he wore his life on his skin, that his biography was written in his flesh and on his bones. She would never ask him why he wouldn't wear short sleeves, even in the steamiest of weather, or why he didn't like to be touched, or, most important, what had happened to his legs or back. She knew already. Around her, he had felt none of the constant anxiety nor watchfulness that he seemed condemned to feel around everyone else. The vigilance was exhausting, but it eventually became simply a part of life, a habit like good posture. Once, she had reached out to, he later realized, embrace him, but he had reflexively brought his hands up over his head to protect himself. And although he had been embarrassed, she hadn't made him feel silly or overreactive. "I'm an idiot, Jude," she'd said instead. "I'm sorry. No more sudden movements, I promise." But now she was gone, and no one knew him. His records were sealed. His first Christmas, Leslie had sent him a card, addressed to him through the student affairs office, and he had kept it for days, his last link to Anna, before finally throwing it away. He never wrote back, and he never heard from Leslie again. It was a new life. He was determined not to ruin it for himself. Still, sometimes, he thought back to their final conversations, mouthing them aloud. This was at night when his roommates, in various configurations, depending on who was in the room at the time, slept above and next to him. "Don't let this silence become a habit," she'd warned him shortly before she died. And, "It's all right to be angry, Jude. You don't have to hide it." She had been wrong about him, he always thought. He wasn't what she thought he was. "You're destined for greatness, kid," she'd said once, and he wanted to believe her, even though he couldn't. But she was right about one thing. It did get harder and harder. He did blame himself. And although he tried every day to remember the promise he'd made to her, every day it became more and more remote, until it was just a memory. And so was she. A beloved character from a book he'd read long ago. "The world has two kinds of people," Judd Sullivan used to say. "Those who are inclined to believe and those who aren't. In my courtroom, we value belief. Belief in all things." He made this proclamation often, and after doing so, he would groan himself to his feet, he was very fat, and toddle out of the room. This was usually at the end of the day, Sullivan's day at least, When he left his chambers and came over to speak to his law clerks, sitting on the edge of one of their desks and delivering often opaque lectures that were interspersed with frequent pauses, as if his clerks were not lawyers, but scriveners, and should be writing down his words. But no one did, not even Kerrigan, who was a true believer and the most conservative of the three of them. After the judge left, he would grin across the room at Thomas, who would raise his eyes upward in a gesture of helplessness and apology. Thomas was a conservative, too, but a thinking conservative, he'd remind him. And the fact that I even have to make that distinction is fucking depressing. He and Thomas had started clerking for the judge the same year, and when he had been approached by the judge's informal search committee, really his business association's professor, with whom the judge was old friends, the spring of his second year of law school, it had been Harold who had encouraged him to apply. Sullivan was known among his fellow circuit court judges for always hiring one clerk whose political views diverged from his own, the more wildly the better. His last liberal law clerk had gone on to work for a Hawaiian rights sovereignty group that advocated for the island's secession from the United States, a career move that had sent the judge into a fit of apoplectic self-satisfaction. "Sullivan hates me," Harold had told him then, sounding pleased. "He'll hire you just to spite me." He smiled, savoring the thought. "And because you're the most brilliant student I've ever had," he added. The compliment made him look at the ground. Harold's praise tended to be conveyed to him by others, and was rarely handed to him directly. "I'm not sure I'm liberal enough for him," he'd replied. Certainly he wasn't liberal enough for Harold. It was one of the things, his opinions, the way he read the law, how he applied it to life, that they argued about. Harold snorted. "Trust me," he said, "you are." But when he went to Washington for his interview the following year, Sullivan had talked about the law and political philosophy with much less vigor and specificity than he had anticipated. "I hear that you sing," Sullivan said instead after an hour of conversation about what he had studied. The judge had attended the same law school, and his position as the article's editor on the Law Review, the same position the judge himself had held, and his thoughts on recent cases. "I do," he replied, wondering how the judge had learned that. Singing was his comfort, but he rarely did it in front of others. Had he been singing in Harold's office and been overheard? Or sometimes he sang in the law library when he was reshelving books late at night, and the space was quiet and still as a church. Had someone overheard him there?
"Sing me something," said the judge.
"What would you like to hear, sir?" he asked.
Normally he would have been much more nervous, but he had heard that the judge would make him do a performance of some sort. Legend had it that he'd made a previous applicant juggle, and Sullivan was a known opera lover. The judge put his fat fingers to his fat lips, and thought. He said.
"Sing me something that tells me something about you."
He thought, and then sang. He was surprised to hear what he chose, Mahler's Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen, both because he didn't even really like Mahler that much, and because the Lied was a difficult one to perform, slow and mournful and subtle and not meant for a tenor. And yet he liked the poem itself, which his voice teacher in college had dismissed as second-rate romanticism, but which he had always thought suffered unfairly from a poor translation. The standard interpretation of the first line was, "I am lost to the world," but he read it as, "I have become lost to the world," which he believed was less self-pitying, less melodramatic, and more resigned. More confused. "I have become lost to the world in which I otherwise wasted so much time." The Lied was about the life of an artist, which he was definitely not, but he understood, primally almost, the concept of losing, of loosing oneself from the world, of disappearing into a different place, one of retreat and safety, of the twinned yearnings of escape and discovery. "It means nothing to me," whether the world believes me dead, I can hardly say anything to refute it, for truly, I am no longer a part of the world. When he finished, he opened his eyes to the judge, clapping and laughing.
Bravo, he said. Bravo! But I think you might be in the wrong profession altogether, you know.
He laughed again.
Where'd you learn to sing like that?
The brothers, sir, he'd replied.
Ah, a Catholic boy,
asked the judge, sitting up fatly in his chair and looking ready to be pleased.
I was raised Catholic, he began.
But you're not now?
The judge asked, frowning.
No,
he said. He had worked for years to keep the apology out of his voice when he said this. Sullivan made a noncommittal grunting noise.
Well, whatever they gave you should have offered at least some sort of protection against whatever Harold Stein's been filling your head with for the past few years, he said.
He looked at his resume.
You're his research assistant?
Yes, he said. For more than 2 years.
A good mind wasted,
Sullivan declared. It was unclear whether he meant his or Harold's.
Thanks for coming down. We'll be in touch. And thanks for the lead. You have one of the most beautiful tenors I've heard in a long time. Are you sure you're in the right field?
At this, he smiled, the last time he would ever see Sullivan smile with such pleasure and sincerity. Back in Cambridge, he told Harold about his meeting.
You sing? Harold asked him,
as if he'd just told him he flew, but that he was certain he wouldn't get the clerkship. A week later, Sullivan called. The job was his. He was surprised, but Harold wasn't. I told you so, he said. The next day, he went to Harold's office as usual, but Harold had his coat on.
Normal work is suspended today, he announced. I need you to run some errands with me.
This was unusual, but Harold was unusual. At the curb, he held out the keys.
Do you want to drive?
Sure, he said, and went to the driver's side. This was the car he'd learned to drive in just a year ago, while Harold sat next to him, far more patient outside the classroom than he was in it.
Good, he'd said. Let go of the clutch a little more. Good. Good, Jude. Good.
Harold had to pick up some shirts he'd had altered, and they drove to the small, expensive men's store on the edge of the square where Willem had worked his senior year.
Come in with me, Harold instructed him. I'm going to need some help carrying these out.
My God, Harold, how many shirts did you buy?
He asked. Harold had an unvarying wardrobe of blue shirts, white shirts, brown corduroys for winter, linen pants for spring and summer, and sweaters in various shades of greens and blues.
Quiet you, said Harold.
Inside, Harold went off to find a salesperson, and he waited, running his fingers over the ties in their display cases, rolled and shiny as pastries. Malcolm had given him two of his old cotton suits, which he'd had tailored and had worn throughout both of his summer internships, but he'd had to borrow his roommate's suit for the Sullivan interview, and he had tried to move carefully in it the entire time it was his, aware of its largeness and the fineness of its wool.
Then, that's him, he heard Harold say. And when he turned, Harold was standing with a small man who had a measuring tape draped around his neck like a snake. He'll need two suits, a dark gray and a navy. And let's get him a dozen shirts, a few sweaters, some ties, socks, shoes. He doesn't have anything.
To him, he nodded and said, This is Marco. I'll be back in a couple of hours or so.
Wait, he said. Harold, what are you doing?
Jude, said Harold, you need something to wear.
I'm hardly an expert on this front, but you can't show up to Sullivan's chambers wearing what you're wearing.
He was embarrassed by his clothes, by his inadequacy, by Harold's generosity.
I know, he said, but I can't accept this, Harold.
He would have continued, but Harold stepped between him and Marco and turned him away.
Jude, he said, accept this. You've earned it. What's more, you need it. I'm not going to have you humiliating me in front of Sullivan.
Besides, I've already paid for it, and I'm not getting my money back. Right, Marco? He called behind him.
Right, said Marco, immediately.
I'll leave it, Jude, he said, when he saw him about to speak. I've got to go. And he marched out without looking back. And so he found himself standing before the triple-leafed mirror, watching the reflection of Marco busying about his ankles, but when Marco reached up his leg to measure the inseam, he flinched reflexively.
Easy, easy, Marco said, as if he were a nervous horse, and patted his thigh, also as if he were a horse, and when he gave another involuntary half-kick as Marco did the other leg,
Hey, I have pins in my mouth, you know. I'm sorry, he said, and held himself still.
When Marco was finished, he looked at himself in his new suit. Here was such anonymity, such protection. Even if someone were to accidentally graze his back, he was wearing enough layers so that they'd never be able to feel the ridges of scars beneath. Everything was covered. Everything was hidden. If he was standing still, he could be anyone, someone blank and invisible.
I think maybe half an inch more, Marco said, pinching the back of the jacket in around the waist.
He swatted some threads off his sleeve.
Now all you need's a good haircut.
He found Harold waiting for him in the tie area, reading a magazine.
Are you done?
He asked, as if the entire trip had been his idea and Harold had been the one indulging his whimsy. Over their early dinner, he tried to thank Harold again, but every time he tried, Harold stopped him with increasing impatience.
Has anyone ever told you that sometimes you just need to accept things, Jude?
He finally asked.
You said to never just accept anything, he reminded Harold.
That's in the classroom and in the courtroom, Harold said. Not in life.
You see, Jude, in life, sometimes nice things happen to good people. You don't need to worry. They don't happen as often as they should. But when they do, it's up to the good people to just say thank you and move on, and maybe consider that the person who's doing the nice thing gets a bang out of it as well, and really isn't in the mood to hear all the reasons that the person for whom he's done the nice thing doesn't think he deserves it or isn't worthy of it.
He shut up then, and after dinner he let Harold drive him back to his apartment on Hereford Street.
Besides, Harold said as he was getting out of the car, you looked really, really nice. You're a great-looking kid. I hope someone's told you that before. And then, before he could protest, acceptance, Jude. So he swallowed what he was going to say.
Thank you, Harold, for everything.
You're very welcome, Jude, said Harold. I'll see you Monday. He stood on the sidewalk and watched Harold's car drive away, and then went up to his apartment, which was on the second floor of a brownstone adjacent to an MIT fraternity house. The brownstone's owner, a retired sociology professor, lived on the ground floor and leased out the remaining three floors to graduate students. On the top floor were Santosh and Federico, who were getting their doctorates in electrical engineering at MIT, and on the third floor were Janusz and Isidore, who were both PhD candidates at Harvard, Janusz in biochemistry and Isidore in Near Eastern religions, and directly below them were he and his roommate, Charlie Ma, whose real name was Qianming Ma, and whom everyone called C.M. C.M. was an intern at Tufts Medical Center, and they kept almost entirely opposite schedules. He would wake, and C.M.'s door would be closed, and he would hear his wet, snuffly snores, and when he returned home in the evenings, at 8, after working with Harold, C.M. would be gone. What he saw of C.M. he liked. He was from Taipei and had gone to boarding school in Connecticut and had a sleepy, roguish grin that made you want to smile back at him. And he was a friend of Andy's friend, which was how they had met. Despite his perpetual air of stoned languor, C.M. was tidy as well and liked to cook. He'd come home sometimes and find a plate of fried dumplings in the center of the table with a note beneath that read, Eat me. Or, occasionally, receive a text instructing him to rotate the chicken in its marinade before he went to bed, or asking him to pick up a bunch of cilantro on his way home.
He always would, and would return to find the chicken simmered into a stew, or the cilantro minced and folded into scallop pancakes. Every few months or so, when their schedules intersected, all six of them would meet in Santosh and Federico's apartment, theirs was the largest, and eat and play poker. Janusz and Isidore would worry aloud that girls thought they were gay because they were always hanging out with each other. CM cut his eyes toward him. He had bet him $20 that they were sleeping together but were trying to pretend they were straight. At any rate, an impossible thing to prove. And Santosh and Federico would complain about how stupid their students were and about how the quality of MIT undergraduates had really gone downhill since their time there 5 years ago. His and CM's was the smallest of the apartments because the landlord had annexed half of the floor to make a storage room. CM paid significantly more of the rent, so he had the bedroom. He occupied a corner of the living room, the part with the bay window. His bed was a floppy foam egg carton pallet, and his books were lined up under the windowsill, and he had a lamp and a folding paper screen to give him some privacy. He and CM had bought a large wooden table which they placed in the dining room alcove and which had two metal folding chairs, one discarded from Janusz, the other from Federico. One half of the table was his, the other half CM's, and both halves were stacked with books and papers and their laptops, both emitting their chirps and burbles throughout the day and night. People were always stunned by the apartment's bleakness, but he had mostly ceased to notice it, although not entirely. Now, for example, he sat on the floor before the three cardboard boxes in which he stored his clothes and lifted his new sweaters and shirts and socks and shoes from their envelopes of white tissue paper, placing them in his lap one at a time. They were the nicest things he had ever owned, and it seemed somehow shameful to put them in boxes meant to hold file folders. And so, finally, he rewrapped them and returned them carefully to their shopping bags. The generosity of Harold's gift unsettled him. First, there was the matter of the gift itself. He had never, never received anything so grand. Second, there was the impossibility of ever adequately repaying him. And third, there was the meaning behind the gesture. He had known for some time that Harold respected him and even enjoyed his company. But was it possible that he was someone important to Harold? That Harold liked him more than as just a student, but as a real, actual friend? And if that was the case, why should it make him so self-conscious? It had taken him many months to feel truly comfortable around Harold, not in the classroom or in his office, but outside of the classroom, outside of the office. In life, as Harold would say. He would return home after dinner at Harold's house and feel a flush of relief. He knew why, too, as much as he didn't want to admit it to himself. Traditionally, men, adult men, which he didn't yet consider himself among, had been interested in him for one reason, and so he had learned to be frightened of them. But Harold didn't seem to be one of those men, although Brother Luke hadn't seemed to be one of those men either. He was frightened of everything, it sometimes seemed, and he hated that about himself. Fear and hatred, fear and hatred. Often it seemed that those were the only two qualities he possessed. Fear of everyone else, hatred of himself. He had known of Harold before he met him, for Harold was known. He was a relentless questioner. Every remark you made in his class would be seized upon and pecked at in an unending volley of whys. He was trim and tall and had a way of pacing in a tight circle, his torso pitched forward when he was engaged or excited. To his disappointments, there was much he simply couldn't remember from that first year contracts class with Harold. He couldn't remember, for example, the specifics of the paper he wrote that interested Harold and which led to conversations with him outside the classroom and, eventually, to an offer to become one of his research assistants. He couldn't remember anything particularly interesting he said in class, but he could remember Harold on that first day of the semester, pacing and pacing and lecturing them in his low, quick voice.
"You're 1Ls," Harold had said, "and congratulations, all of you. As 1Ls, you'll be taking a pretty typical course load, contracts, torts, property, civil procedure, and next year, constitutional and criminal